Hi, folks. This is Leo Over. Session is going to be entitled Scalable Oncology-Based Information Systems. Professor Ian Horrocks is going to give the talk, and the date is July 22nd, 2010. I'd like to introduce Professor Horrocks, who we're very happy to have give this talk. Professor Horrocks is a professor at the Oxford University Computing Lab, where he's jointly leading the information systems group. He was deeply and centrally involved in the development of the oral, the AMLplus oral and OWL ontology languages, and in fact recently co-chair of the working group W3C that developed OWL2. He's also the general chair for the upcoming ISWIC, which is the 9th International Semantic Web Conference, held this year in Shanghai, China, November 11th through 17th. He has many varied research interests, including knowledge representation, ontology, and ontology languages, modal and description logic, and probably and many folks know him for his contributions to those, automated reasoning and implementation and optimization of reasoning systems. His application areas have been focused on e-science and the semantic web in particular. He's also developed algorithms and implementation techniques that have been incorporated into reasoning systems and implemented the well-known FACT system, which many folks use. He has published more than 150 articles and conferences, journals, and books, and has given more than 40 keynote and invited talks. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Professor Horrocks, who will be talking now about scalable ontology-based information systems. Ian, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the very kind introduction. Actually, I don't know if the infrastructure will really support it, but from my point of view, I'd be perfectly happy to have people interrupt me with questions as I go along. If I really say something that, you know, you can't swallow at all, then feel free to put your hand up and maybe Leo will be able to field your question at that point, but that's dependent on the infrastructure. Okay, I'll start off. I suppose we can all see the title slide at this point, which just repeats the information that Leo has given you. So let's move straight on to slide number 2, where I'll start off by trying to explain what an ontology is, or at least what I think an ontology is. I suppose we've all heard some of these famous short descriptions, such as it's a formalization of a conceptualization, which sounds kind of good. You know, if somebody asks you at a party what is an ontology, that's probably a good way to pop them off. But actually, I don't think it really provides sufficient information for most people's requirements. So if we move on to slide number 3, I'll start saying what I think an ontology is. It's a model of some aspects of the world. So here we have our conceptualization part of the formalization of conceptualization. Then on slide number 4, but to go into look into that in a bit more detail, what does it mean to be a model of some aspect of the world? Well, one particularly important feature is that the ontology should introduce some vocabulary relevant to the domain and that you're going to use in talking about the domain. So, for example, if our domain was anatomy, we might introduce vocabulary of the kind that you can see in this little diagram if you can read it, but you know, the obvious stuff, like we want to talk about heart and aorta and liver and kidney and so on. Then on the next slide, number 5, is another example in cellular biology. They have all their own specialized vocabulary that you would obviously want to introduce in an ontology to use in this domain. Then slide number 6, Aerospace is another area where ontologies have been used, and again, where they have a large and very specialized vocabulary. Unless you've got that eyesight for me, you won't be able to actually read any of the vocabulary on this little diagram here. But, I mean, the point is that complex engineering artifacts are not so different in some ways from complex naturally occurring artifacts like cells, and they're very, describing them requires a lot of specialized vocabulary. On slide number 7, well, we might have a more prosaic domain that we're interested in. Actually, I think someone on the call was interested in dogs by the sound of it, so this would be very appropriate for them. And, you know, even if we're interested in talking about dogs, we might want to have an ontology that, that establishes the vocabulary that we're going to use, and indeed does introduce some specialized terms that most people are not particularly familiar with. And slide number 8. So now we're getting really into the perhaps slightly ridiculous, but, you know, we can see even hot dogs have the specialized vocabulary that we might want to introduce in the vocabulary that defines the meaning of things like toaster, pickled spear, and steamed poppy seed bun. So that's one of the first important aspects. We'll move on to slide number 9. The second crucial thing, and I suppose this is where the formalization part in our short description, is that an ontology shouldn't just introduce a vocabulary, it's not just like a list of words. It should also specify the meaning of the terms that it introduces. For example, if we were back in our anatomy domain and we were describing the heart, we might define that. We don't just introduce the vocabulary heart, but we define what it means by saying that it's a muscular organ that is part of the circulatory system. And you can see that what we're actually doing here is we're introducing a new term, and then we're defining what it means with respect to some of the terms that we already have that are defined elsewhere. So as we move on to slide number 10, so another aspect of the formalization is that typically if we want to use our ontology in a computer system, we want to formalize it in a very precise way so that we're going to be able to do some computation that actually makes use of the semantics and that can use the semantics, for example, to draw conclusions. Typically that means that we want to formalize our semantics, formalize our ontology language using some suitable logic. So instead of writing down this definition of the heart in natural language as I did above, we might use first order logic to write down this little sentence here, this first order logic sentence that captures more or less the same meaning as above. So it says for x, if x is a heart, then x is also a muscular organ, and there exists some y, such that x is a part of y, and y is a circulatory system. So this is the formalization of saying the heart is a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system. Okay, so as we move on to slide 11, so the most widely used ontology language today is this language that probably many of you are familiar with. So, yeah, the most widely used ontology language is OWL, which I guess many of us are familiar with. And, I mean, it's sometimes difficult to separate cause and effect, but, you know, why is it widely used? It's because, I suppose, it's a W3C recommendation, so it's some kind of a standard. And the existence of this language is motivated by the W3C semantic web activity, the goal of which was to add meaning to web content by annotating it with terms that are defined in ontology. And it was postulated that a requirement for doing that, not unreasonably, would be to have a standard ontology language so that we could share these meanings across the web. Another aspect of OWL, which again it's hard to decide which is the cause and which is the effect, is that OWL is supported by now a very large and constantly increasing range of tools and infrastructure. And, you know, whether they exist because OWL is widely used or OWL is widely used because they exist, I'm not really sure. But nevertheless, I think in order for a language to get some traction in applications, you need to have these kinds of tools and infrastructure available. And for OWL, well, there are the standard APIs, there are several of those. I think the OWL API is the most widely used one. There are now numerous ontology development environments available, well-known examples including Protégé, Operate Composer, and others. And there are numerous reasoners and information systems that use OWL. So, that's what Plus has already mentioned, Pellet, Racer, Termit, Quanto, there are lots of them. Another interesting thing to mention about OWL, which speaks to the last point I was mentioning on the previous slide, is that OWL is based on a description logic. So the ontology language, when you're using OWL, you are, whether you realize it or not, formalizing the meaning of the ontology in a fragment of the logic. So that was considered an important design feature. And the second purpose of the logic that was chosen as the basis for OWL was the description logic. So if we go on to the next slide, I'll say something about description logics and hopefully explain why it was the description logics were chosen as the basis for OWL. As I already mentioned, description logics are actually nothing more than fragments of the logic that are specifically tailored towards knowledge representation applications. Important features of these fragments are their computational properties. And in designing description logics, one feature that was considered to be essential was that objects should be decidable. That is, it should be possible, in principle at least, to answer arbitrary questions with respect to arbitrary ontologies. It should be at least in theory possible to do that. A desirable property is also that the fragments have low complexity. So I would say that what that really means is we'd like the performance of our system to be robust. High complexity doesn't necessarily mean that the system is unusable, the language is unusable. But what it does mean is that usability tends to be a little bit fragile, so if you just change a relatively innocuous-looking thing in your ontology, the performance of query answering can then change a lot. If you have low complexity, that's much less likely to be the case. So it's nice if you can have low complexity and you can have this kind of computational performance robustness. I prefer to think of it that way rather than saying low complexity, good performance, high complexity, bad performance, because I think that's really oversimplifying things. Another feature of description logic is that they have a slightly more usable syntax than first order logic. So they dispense with variables. And because the standard form of statements in description logic are these kinds of definitions, vocabulary definitions. These are there's a syntax form for that built into the language that avoids having to have this quantifier outside of the whole statement. And because we're restricted to binary predicates and a restricted use of quantifiers, we can also even dispense with the explicit use of variables inside the statement. So this heart being a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system, the sentence in first order logic an exactly equivalent sentence in description logic, the syntax of that looks like what's written at the bottom of the slide there. But the meaning is exactly the same, and in fact one could just take a language like OWL and trivially translate the whole thing back into the standard first order syntax that we see above. What slide is he on? I'm on slide 12.
Okay. Oh, yes.
So slide number 13, actually, is the name. So a description logic knowledge base actually consists of two parts, one of which is corresponds directly to what we typically think of as being an ontology. That is a kind of schema description of the terminology, the vocabulary that we're going to use. In a description logic, this is called the T-box or terminology box. This is where we introduce all of the vocabulary, the terminology, and we define it in the way I've been mentioning above. So you can see I might have the definition of a heart. I might equally define heart disease as being a disease that affects the heart. And I might define vascular disease as being a disease that affects part of the circulatory system. And you can see that what we typically do when we build an ontology like this is that we build more and more complex terms or terms that have more and more complex definitions by reusing terms that we've already defined. There's another part to a description logic. Oh, one thing I didn't mention here, by the way, if you look closely, you'll see that the first axiom, we typically call these kinds of statements defining vocabulary axioms. In the first axiom, you'll see that the operator that in the middle there is this square subset equal to sign. And what that means is that if I have a heart, then I know that the stuff on the right-hand side is true. But if the stuff on the right-hand side is true, I can't deduce that what I have is a heart. So it's the sort of implication going from left to right. In the next two axioms, you'll see that I have these equivalent symbols written in the middle. And what that means is it's really a bidirectional implication. So heart disease means that it's a disease that affects the heart, and if I find a disease that affects the heart, then I can conclude that that is a heart disease, and similarly for vascular disease. So we have these two kinds of definitions, the ones that just go from left to right, and the ones that go in both directions. Then the other part of the description logic knowledge base is what's called in description logic speak an A box, which stands for assertion box. And this is where we use the introduced terminology from the ontology to state some facts about individuals. And in first order logic, we typically call these ground facts. In the database setting, we just call this the data, the ontology schema, this is the data. And the sort of fact we might want to say is something like, John is an instance of a patient who suffers from heart disease. So John is a patient who suffers from heart disease. We might say that as a fact. So if we can move on to slide 14. So I've been talking a lot about semantics, and I like to take a little sidestep here just to ask the question that many people have asked. Why do we care so much about these formal semantics? Is it really all that important? You have to be a little brave to ask this question in a way, in the, you know, setting of the semantic web, being as semantics is supposedly central to everything. But we have our little questioner here who we'll call Bob, and but it turns out that, you know, Bob is a brave guy and he's not worried about being stoned to death, so he decides to ask this question, why should I care about semantics? So on the next slide, number 16, okay, Bob's asking the question. On slide 17, we introduce our good friend Bertram Russell, who we luckily have with us today, to answer this question, why should I care about semantics? So on slide 18, Bertram comes along with one of his pearls of philosophical wisdom, which is that, well, from a philosophical point of view, we need to specify the relationship between statements in the logic and the existential phenomena they describe, which is, you know, I'm afraid that's the way Bertrand speaks all the time. We just have to learn to live with it. So, well, Bob, on slide 19, comes back with, well, you know, this is okay, but I don't actually get paid for philosophy. What Bob wants to do is actually use an ontology in an application. Why should we care about semantics? He doesn't really care much about existential phenomenon in the world. So, well, fortunately, Bertrand is, you know, up to the task, and on slide 20, he comes back with a bit more of a kind of down-to-earth explanation of why we should worry about semantics. I mean, it's as simple as the fact that the semantics are really just the specification for what an ontology-based information system should do. If I'm going to use such a system or develop such a system, I need to know what the right, given an ontology and a query, I need to know what is the right answer to that, so that I know what the intended behavior of my system is, and I can build a system and test whether it really does give the right answer. So semantics are really nothing more than a specification of what the right answer is. And I think, I hope that most people will agree that that is a good thing to have. If we're going to build software, we should at least have a good set of what the, you know, what it's supposed to do. Later on, we can determine whether or not it actually does it, but we just know at the beginning what it's supposed to do. Okay, so back to the, on slide 21, we can sort of, having hopefully convinced ourselves that semantics is a good idea, but, you know, we've now got ourselves into a bit of a skeptical sort of frame of mind here, so having asked the question what the semantics look for, we might go on and say, well, okay, but what are ontologies really good for? Well, in the first place, one thing they're good for is just providing a coherent, user-centric view of the domain. So, actually, one of the disadvantages of database schemas, for example, is that the schema, although we might start out with a kind of entity relationship model that reflects the user's view of the domain, pretty soon we end up typically with a schema that rather reflects the database designer's view of what might be efficient way of dividing things up into tables and so on, rather than really a kind of conceptual model of the domain. Ontologies are better in that regard in that they tend to be more focused on the user's view of the domain and they provide this conceptual model of that. It's quite useful just for groups of people who are having a conversation in the same domain to sit down together and try to design an ontology in that domain just so that they can make sure that they really do mean the same thing when they say the same word or words. And it very often turns out actually there were, small, sometimes even large, misunderstandings or disagreements about what the meaning of terms are. And it's very useful to sit down, tease those out, and did not resolve them in the sense that we all end up agreeing on the meaning of some particular term, because that's never going to happen. You know, we're all going to have a different idea of, you know, what the meaning of various controversial terms is, but at least in the ontology, we can formalize what the meaning is with respect to this application we're going to use the ontology in, and you can agree with that or disagree with that, but it's precisely specified. So ontologies are good for that, but that's more of a sort of social thing. It doesn't speak too much to what we might want to do with ontologies in an information system setting. So what about information systems? What advantage do ontologies give us there? Well, as I was hinting when I mentioned before about database schemas, one of the nice things about using ontology-based information systems is that they give a view of the data that's independent of the logical or physical schema. So you devise this conceptual model. At that point, it's completely independent how you're actually storing the data. Another nice thing about ontology-based information systems is that you can implement query answering systems where the answer to the query reflects not only the data, but also information that's in the schema. So if I would like, if I go back to my example, the name, which is this, which is this medical domain, and I ask the query, give me all the patients suffering from vascular disease. If I flip onto the next slide, slide 22, that just refreshes our memory about the little example ontology I showed before, and the one fact that I have, the one piece of data that I have, which is that John is a patient who suffers from heart disease, and I might want to know, is John, in the answer to this query, patient suffering from vascular disease? Obviously, if I were in a database setting, the answer would simply be no. I didn't explicitly state that John is such a patient, and so he isn't going to be in the answer to that query. But if I use the ontology as well as the data, it's fairly easy to see that from the information I have here, I can deduce that John should be in the answer to that query, because heart disease is a kind of vascular disease. You know, it says this in the ontology, and patients suffering from heart disease, therefore, are patients that suffer from vascular disease. So the ontology allows me to return John in the answer to the query, even though just by just looking at the data, I wouldn't be able to do that. So I'm going to move on to slide 23. So there are many more advantages to having an ontology in the mix within my information system. I can use the ontology to do things like query expansion, query navigation, query refinement. So if my query is too general and I'm getting too many answers, I can sort of navigate down the ontology to try and refine the query, or the other way around. I can use ontologies to help me to deal with incomplete and semi-structured data. Ontologies allow me a way to I just noticed a sort of rather long question from Amanda, but I'm afraid that's too long for me to really read and respond to now without interrupting the flow. So I'll come back to that at the end. We'll have some time for discussion. So ontologies help dealing with incomplete and semi-structured data because you can specify a bit more precisely what null means, basically. So in databases, the only way you have to deal with missing incomplete information is null. In ontologies, you can specify much more precisely what that means. You can use ontologies as well as a kind of global vocabulary that you can then use to integrate information coming from heterogeneous sources. So lots of uses. Slide 24, please. I just want to very quickly just mention a couple of areas where ontology is already being widely used. So I've been using medicine as a sort of running example. And ontologies are very widely used in medicine, ontology-based information systems, to do things like selecting patients for screening. And it's very important that you get the selection right there, because if you select too many patients, then you're not just wasting money screening them, you're actually harming them, because you cause them stress and you subject them to procedures that are actually inappropriate. But on the other hand, obviously, too little screening potentially risks patient lives. So it's important to have the best possible information systems there to answer questions in this domain. So slide 25. Yeah, and I mean, for the person who actually, it's that Bill Hogan sort of made a nice comment about, you know, he doesn't agree that heart disease is a subtype of vascular diseases. But this was exactly the point I was making about ontologies being useful, just for teasing out differences in our understanding of terms. And actually, in the ontology I'm using here, it is an absolute fact that ontology is that heart disease is a subtype of vascular disease according to that ontology. So, and you can see precisely what the definition of those terms are and see that that does follow from those definitions. Now, it may be those definitions are wrong, and it may be that when we discover that according to these definitions, heart disease is a kind of vascular disease, that might ring some alarm bells. We might have a discussion with Bill, and Bill might persuade us that that's wrong, and then Bill has to explain to us also how to fix our ontology, so that's no longer the case. But then, you know, we're having a dialogue with respect to precise specifications of our vocabulary, and hopefully at the end of the day, even if we never succeed in making our vocabulary be perfect, we can constantly be improving it and, you know, querying it to see if it is consistent with our intuitions about how the world is really structured. So thanks for that question, Bill. It actually illustrated very nicely the point I was trying to make. Ontology shouldn't be confused with the truth. They are a precise specification of some conceptualization of the world, which could be completely wrong, but at least it's precisely specified. So coming back to the examples I was running through, just in case I was giving the impression that medicine is the only area where ontology is used, actually we have a very nice collaboration with people in the oil and gas industry that are interested in integrating information from lots of different sources and making better use of that information to inform the decisions that they make in, for example, the way they set the various different production parameters on their platforms. And they estimate that improving the access to and use of the information that they have could add billions of euros per year to the value of production. So slide 26. Yeah, I don't want to go on too long about these examples because I could go on all day, but, you know, another example here from SAP where they need better access to information for supporting their customers. Slide 27. Yeah, this was just a very nice example that struck me at the time when the, I think this was around about the time when the, who was it? Was this to do with the underpants, the famous underpants bomber? I said, yeah. But anyway, Barack Obama, in response to some failure of the security services, commented that we have sufficient information, but we failed to integrate and understand it. So ontology-based information systems, one of the things they're good at is helping us to integrate and understand complex and heterogeneous information. So slide 28. Yeah, another concrete healthcare example, which I don't want to say too much about, but in the UK, the health service here is spending a huge amount of money. It saves 10 billion here, but I think they already ran over budget on building a new information system for the health service. A key component of that is going to be the patient record system, which is going to become fully electronic. Of course, it has to be available 24/7. And one of the interesting features of that system is that it actually uses an ontology, a rather well-known ontology called SNOMED-CP, to provide the vocabulary for the data that's stored in the patient record system. So on slide number 29, just saying something about SNOMED, it's a huge ontology. It has over 400,000 concepts defined in it. It actually uses one of the OWL profiles called the OWL profile, which is a subset of the OWL 2 language. I'm going to say quite a bit more about profiles in a minute. And it defines quite rich definitions of concepts. We look at slide number 30. I've got a screenshot here from the tool that the SNOMED team uses to maintain, to develop and maintain the ontology. And this is the screenshot that shows the information in the ontology for the term pulmonary tuberculosis. And there's quite a lot of information there. It's kind of pneumonitis, it's kind of tuberculosis, it's a kind of pulmonary disease that's due to mycobacteria, it's found in the lungs, and so on. You can see in this right-hand pane here, there's a lot of information about just this one vocabulary term, and there are 400,000 terms, each one of which may have a definition as rich or richer than this one. So slide number 31. So if we start talking about ontologies of that size with a relatively rich definition, we might start to ask ourselves the question, what about scalability? So I've been sort of making a pitch for how useful ontology-based information systems are, but of course they're only useful in practice if we can deal with these kinds of large ontologies and potentially also with large data sets. So what's the story about scalability? Well, I mentioned back at the beginning when I was talking about basing our own description logics that a desirable feature of description logics would be low complexity, or of any logic really to use the current ontology language would be low complexity. Unfortunately, it's very hard to achieve low complexity while still having a language that's sufficiently rich to allow you to define the domain in the way that you would like. Somebody popped in with a question there about how we define the notion of quality for ontology. I think that's one I'll punt off to the end if you don't mind, because it's not really particularly pertinent to the current slides, and it's a kind of a big question. It's a very good question, but it's not one that I can really give a happy answer to. So, yeah, coming back to the issue of complexity, unfortunately, many ontologies the complexity of reasoning with them, of answering queries over them, is very high. So, actually, it's known that just checking the satisfiability of an OWL2 ontology is doubly non-deterministically exponential with respect to the size of the ontology. So as you grow the ontology, the difficulty of even just checking that it's logically consistent can, in the worst case, grow very rapidly. I must emphasize here that these complexity results are worst-case scenarios, and as I was saying before, it doesn't mean that OWL2 is unusable. What it does mean is if you use all of the features of the language, you can expect some lack of robustness in performance. So you might have an ontology that's performing perfectly well on Monday, and then you make some slight tweaks to it overnight, and on Tuesday, queries that were coming back on Monday in microseconds now suddenly take, you know, minutes, hours, or days. And so that's what I mean by lack of robustness. Just trying to read one of the questions here that came up. Can you speak to the fragility of description logic in the face of a less than perfect ontology? Well, I'll just very briefly respond to that, and then we can come back to that at the end as well. It's not a magic bullet. This is very related to Bill's question. Bill disagreed about the meaning of something, and what description logic allow you to do is precisely determine what follows from what statements you made in the ontology. If those statements are incorrect or imperfect, then what follows may be incorrect or imperfect. But the ontology, a logic-based language, allows you to build tools that help you to investigate that. So you can ask queries and you can get back answers. And if those answers seem to be weird to you, according to your understanding of the domain, then you can determine that something may be wrong with the ontology. And the tools that are available today even provide with some sort of diagnostic. So if you say, hey, you know, that thing that follows from the ontology, according to me, that's not correct. Well, the tool can then give you a diagnosis of where that entailment came from, and you can look at those parts of the ontology and figure out whether you think there's a mistake there. So it's not a solution to the problem of that in any very large artifact like this there will be errors and infelicities, but it provides you at least with some kind of tool base for trying to attack that problem. So popping back to what I was saying about scalability, of course that benefit and all the other benefits of using an ontology is only any good if we can deal with ontologies in practice. So we have this problem that the ontologies may be very large. So Frank's question here I'll come back to later, because actually OWL does have many profiles for dealing with improving the worst case complexity. And I'm coming on to that now, so I'll just plow on with my presentation, and I hope I'll answer that question as I go. And I'm not looking at your question, Leo, I'm afraid, because it's just too long for me to read right now.
That's right.
So how do we address this problem of tractability, scalability in practice? And basically, there are two, at least three different approaches to that. A, we try to design algorithms that work well in typical cases. So these very high complexity classes, the, you know, possibly exponential behavior, is a sort of theoretical worst case result. We hope that that never really arises in practice. You would have to do something, you know, deliberately nasty in order to make that arise in practice. And in fact, in any concrete case, you can always come up with optimization techniques that deal fairly effectively with that concrete case. What you can't guarantee when you have this very high complexity is that your algorithms and optimizations will always work, regardless of what the user puts in the ontology. So if you're really worried about scalability and predictability of performance for query answers and so on, then we may decide that we prefer to use a fragment, a tractable fragment of the language that has better worst-case complexity. And these, there are several such fragments in OWL 2, and they're called profiles in OWL 2. So if we move on to slide number 32, I'm going to have to start cutting fairly quickly through some of the material here, which is fine. I expected to do that ahead of time. I sort of put all this material in the slide deck so that people can look at some of the examples of how tabular algorithms work and so on. You can look at that later if you're motivated and interested in that. I'll just give you a very high level explanation here, and then I'll have to jump on to some other stuff, otherwise we're never going to get around to the question and answer section. So, yeah, 533. So the standard technique that's used in many existing reasoning systems like FRAC, FRAC++, PELOS, and so on, are these tableau reasoning algorithms. And the basic idea behind them is they reduce queries to testing satisfiability. So, for example, if we want to ask this question that we were interested in before, is it true that heart disease is a kind of vascular disease, or at least is that entailed by the ontology that I have right now? So I'm asking that question, and what these tableau algorithms do is they reduce that to the satisfiability question by sort of adding to the ontology a counterexample. So if it's not true, then it should be possible to have some individual that's an instance of heart disease and isn't an instance of vascular disease. So I add an assertion to my ontology that's about the existence of just such an individual. So this X I have here is an individual within this class of heart disease and not vascular disease. And if that is satisfiable, then I have a counterexample straight away, and it's clear that this isn't entailed by my ontology. If I prove that that's not satisfiable, then what I've shown is that it's impossible that any such individual could exist, and so the hypothesized entailment does in fact hold. So 534, and the way the algorithm works is it tries to construct such a model. So it starts out with this ontology, with this new individual X, with an instance of heart disease and not vascular disease, and it sees if it can build a complete model, a sort of extended ontology that explicates all of the facts about X and demonstrates that that's consistent with the facts that I have in my ontology. I'm not going to have time now to go through this example step by step, and it's probably a bit difficult to do it anyway without being in a more sort of interactive environment. So I think what we should do here is kind of flip forward. So I don't know off the top of my head. Let me just have a look at my slides at the top of the side here, and I'll see which slide I'm going to tell Leo to jump forward to. So yeah, if you jump forward to slide number 50, all the intermediate slides are just stepping through the example. So if we jump through to slide number 50, then you can play with those off, you know, offline and convince yourself that this process of trying to build a model is a way to prove satisfiability. So that's the basis for the way the algorithm works underneath. In order to make that be effective in realistic cases, we actually need to do a lot of engineering as well. I mean, actually, those kind of tabular algorithms are really simple, and for a slightly simpler language than OWL, but still a non-trivial one, you can have one of your students implement a tabular algorithm that can prove the satisfiability of ontologies, you know, in a day or two. It's really quite simple. But to transform that into a tool that you can really use with ontologies having 400,000 definitions in them requires quite a lot of engineering work, and we have to do lots of optimization. And these are just some of the optimization techniques that are known in practice. So laser folding, I don't have time to tell you what they all are, but again, you can look at these. The point is that in the end, actually, we end up with an implementation that isn't even computationally optimal. So typically, you can show that the algorithms that are used in implemented systems have an even worse case complexity than the underlying language does, but all these optimization techniques result in something that's fairly effective in realistic cases. So I'm just having a quick look at some of the questions that's popping along, and I'm getting a bit behind schedule here, so I think I'll carry on through, and then we'll go with a question and answer session at the end, which is actually going to work much better, I think. So, slide 51. So, but, you know, the point actually is that no matter what we do with implementation and optimization techniques, problems can still arise, particularly if we have these very large ontologies, or ontologies that include cycles in the definitions, which arise quite commonly in things like medical terminology settings and other complex physically structured domains. So you can see this example here where we're defining parts of the heart, and we're saying the left side of the heart has a component of the aortic valve. the aortic valve is connected to the left ventricle, and the left ventricle is a division of the left side of the heart. So we've gone around in a circle there. And you can imagine that for these sort of deductive systems, that can often cause the reason path to get much harder. And if we have ontologies that are behind tens or hundreds of thousands of terms, this can lead to our satisfiability test trying to construct a model that is very, very large, and that then can be costly. It can lead to scalability issues. So slide 52. Another problem that might cause scalability issues is if we have very large data sets. So what I've been describing up to now with respect to reasoning has mainly been conceptual level reasoning, so asking questions like, is a heart disease a kind of a vascular disease? But in many applications, what people want to do really is ask queries that involve data retrieval. So they may have a very large set of facts, and they want to ask one of these queries like, that we looked at before, that do something like retrieve all the patients who suffer from vascular disease. And in this case, the size of the data is potentially almost limitless. So I was saying 400,000 concepts is very large for an ontology, but of course 400,000 tuples of data would be quite small by the standards of databases. So in a sort of data-centric application, we may need to deal with tens, hundreds of millions, or even more individuals. And that is going to be a problem if we really have to answer all queries by performing one of these satisfiability tests on the ontology. So slide 53. So AL2 addresses this issue by defining several profiles. And these are basically fragments that have desirable computational properties. And two fragments that address these kinds of scalability issues that I was just discussing are the EL profile, which is a profile that's targeted towards people that are trying to build very large ontologies, but then they're mainly interested in building conceptual models. And AL2QL is targeted at people whose focus is mainly on having very large data sets, and their ontologies tend to be smaller and simpler than the people who are building these huge conceptual models of medicine. So slide 54. So one of the advantages of EL, so how was EL designed? I mean, one thing I might say at this point is that I think I saw going by in one of these questions, somebody mentioned light, AL-light. And actually AL-2 doesn't have a light. It has these fragments which have different subsets and have different computational properties, but they really are motivated by being able to provide some, by providing some real benefit. AL-light actually in the original AL language was hardly used at all, and the reason for that was it didn't really offer any benefit because its design wasn't actually based on research into improving complexity or performance. Its design was really based just on a kind of beauty contest where constructors were, a subset of the constructors were chosen for now. But actually, it's subsequently shown that the worst-case complexity of reasoning with AL-light was very little different than for reasoning with AL, even though a lot of constructors have been thrown away. In fact, it was still exponential. In contrast, AL-2EL has been designed based on research into the EL family of description logic to be as near as possible, somewhere near the biggest fragment vowel that we could get that still allowed for polynomial time satisfiability checking. So we wanted to be able to provide a fragment where you could guarantee worst case polynomial behavior. And this is exactly what AL-EL is. A sort of incidental benefit is that we can exploit different kinds of reasoning techniques in particular, we can exploit a new kind of reasoning technique called saturation, which basically computes all of the subsumption, subclass inferences between the terms we defined in our ontology in a single pass. When you use Tableau reasoners, actually to compute this kind of hierarchy of classes, which is what tools like Protégé do when you press the, you know, the reasoner button, they go away and they compute this hierarchy of the classes. They have to do that basically by doing individual comparisons between pairs of classes, and they may perform thousands or even hundreds of thousands of these comparisons, each one of which is a classifiability test, in order to compute the hierarchy. Unfortunately, typically they can perform these tests very quickly, and they have various optimizations that try to minimize the number of tests they need in order to build the hierarchy. But nonetheless, with these very large ontologies like SERMed, that is an issue. In contrast, saturation-based techniques, which you can use with fragments like EL, they compute the whole classification in a single pass. So slide number 55. Here again, I start to explain how saturation-based techniques work, but I'm not going to have time to go through that in the talk, so I'm just going to skip forward to slide number 68. So if you're interested in how those techniques work, you can just look through that, the intervening set of slides there, which give a worked example of how that works. I mean, the crucial thing is that instead of operating on the data and trying to explicate information about the data, the reasoning procedure operates directly on the axioms, and it actually derives new axioms. So they're rather more like a sort of traditional resolution-style reasoning procedure. Just to give a sort of indication of how effective that is, first implementation of such a reasoning technique in the CV reasoner, which is in the next to the bottom row in this table, you can see that, you know, that really achieved a big speed up with many of these larger ontologies. It's 13 times faster than the fastest other reasoner that can even deal with the problem, which is FAT++ for the SNOMED ontology. And in the case of the Galen ontology, which is smaller than SNOMED but has more complex definitions, that actually was unprocessable by any of the reasoners available before this new saturation-based reasoner came along, and it can process it in 9.5 seconds, which represents a pretty good speed up. So, slide number 69. So, it's AL2QL, which is the other fragment I mentioned before. Similarly, this is based on research into tractable subsets in description logic, and in particular on the DL light family of description logic. And this is a near-maximal fragment of AL2, such that, well, this is the technical answer, which is data complexity of conductive query answering is in AC0, but what that really means is that you can compile query answering down into SQL queries and use a standard relational database to answer them. Or, if you prefer, you can compile them down into Sparkle queries and use an RDS store to answer your queries. So, basically, you can use this reasoning procedure called query rewriting, where you take the ontology and you just use the ontology to expand the query a bit, basically. So, okay, we move on to slide 70. I have a feeling that I give an example of how query rewriting really works, which I'm afraid I'm not also going to have to leave for you as homework. So if we skip forward to slide number 72, actually what I just wanted to show you on this slide was just the sort of architecture of query rewriting systems, just to reiterate what the basic idea is, which is you take your query in at the left-hand side, you use the ontology to rewrite the query to give you an expanded query. If your data is sitting in a database, then you need to have some mapping that specifies, you know, how do I get the extension of vascular disease from the database, let's say. So if I use that mapping then to transform the terms in this rewritten query into SQL, and then I can use my database just to answer the query directly without any further reference to the ontology. And basically what that means is that I have logarithmic complexity, data complexity with respect to query answering. In other words, as the size of my data increases, the complexity of query answering only increases logarithmically, which is the same complexity that databases can have. Michael was asking about citations and experiments on slide 68. I think you can find those results in Yevgeny Kazakov's paper that won the best paper prize at IJCAI last year. And there's obviously much more information in there about that technique in general. So hopefully Yevgeny's paper can answer most of your questions about that. So moving on to slide, actually there's more stuff about the technicalities of query writing now, which I'm going to skip over. I just wanted to show you the architectural diagram. So if we skip on to slide 89, then you'll be glad to know I'll be getting close to the end. So slide 89. Again, the intervening slides just give a step-by-step example, a walkthrough example of how query rewriting works for those of you who are interested in that kind of that level of detail. So, hopefully, things are sounding a bit more encouraging now. We have a bunch of tools. They work quite well in practice, even when we come across cases that are challenging from a scalability point of view. We now have defined fragments of the language that have much better computational complexity and tools that we can use for those fragments. So what's left to do? What are the outstanding problems and research challenges? Well, one obvious problem and research challenge in the ontology space is combining the best features of description logics and or first-order logic, I should say. You know, there's a lot of nonsense talk about description logics, and they get sort of demonized in the press sometimes, but actually all of the problematical features are equally problematical features of first-order logic. And in particular, in many application scenarios, the open world assumption can be problematical. We don't necessarily actually always want to make an open world assumption, particularly not with respect to data. In contrast, databases are always making a closed world assumption, and that's also sometimes limiting and inappropriate. In an ideal world, we'd like to be able to specify when we want open world, when we want closed world, which parts of the theory we consider to be open, which parts are fully defined and should be closed. So that's an extremely hard problem. And finding even a coherent semantic framework that allows me to somehow mix open and closed world notions proves to be extremely challenging. And we can somehow see that if we start even trying to figure out what the intuitive answer to questions of form. Does a person owning a phone and an iPod own two things? Well, yes, they probably do. But, you know, what if they own an iPhone? Then, actually, they own a phone and an iPod, but they only actually have one thing. So, you know, this kind of database unique name, closed world or something. Sometimes it works well, sometimes it doesn't work so well. There's quite a lot of interesting work in that space though. Andrea Talley et al. Are doing some very nice work on extending data logs to give this language that they call data log plus minus. And the motivation behind that is to try to extend data log with some of the notions from ontology languages. And going in the other direction, Boris Motik and friends have been looking at how to try to integrate some of the ideas from databases into ontology languages. So a couple of papers that you might be interested to read there. So moving on to slide 90. So actually the story about query rewriting sounds very promising when I presented it the way I did, but actually there still are quite some open questions with respect to query rewriting. If we skip on slide 91, it currently only works for very weak ontology languages. Slide 92. I tried to get rid of some of these slides that are only really, you know, doing animation and bullet points, but obviously didn't get rid of all of them. So one of the other advantages, this problem is that actually the query rewriting can result in the query getting very much larger. And that's particularly a problem if you're going to eventually use a relational database system to answer the query, because they're designed really on the kind of premise that queries will be relatively small. Having said that, there's been some more recent work on optimization techniques and so on. You might like to look at this paper that was presented at the recent DL workshop that showed some pretty encouraging results for using query rewriting in practice. So slide 93. Obviously this is back to the fact that they currently rewriting only works for fairly weak languages, and larger languages may require things like data log engines or some extension to the technique, in particular using partial materialization. And this latter idea, using partial materialization, there's some very nice new work in this area from Carsten Lutz and friends. There was a really good paper on this at ITCHI 2009, and actually there's been some more recent papers describing their work on extending rewriting to bigger languages by doing some partial materialization and then doing rewriting with respect to the expanded data set. So slide 94. Well, flip on slide 95 even. This is more animation, I suppose. So, yeah, we need more infrastructure. So one of the problems that there's been in the community up to now is the lack of a standard query language. But this is obviously currently being addressed by the Sparkle Working Group, who are currently extending Sparkle to cover OWL. So slide 96. Well, this is probably me just being a little bit partial to people in my own research group and highlighting some of their interesting research. But, I mean, we might also be interested in things like privacy, information hiding. I mean, basically, all of the surrounding concerns that one has with respect to information systems, apart from just raw performance. And of course, there have been lots of work on these kinds of things in the database community, and I expect we'll need to see similar kinds of issues addressed in the ontology community. So slide number 97. Yes, dot, dot, dot. Slide number 98. So lots more work to do in that area. Oh, yeah, and I'm just finishing off with an advertisement for ISWC, which was mentioned, which Leo mentioned at the beginning. So, yes, I'm involved in organizing ISWC 2010, which will be in Shanghai, and it will be a really great event. We'll all have great fun there, and we'll be able to find out what's more about ontologies and other good semantic web stuff. So if you move on to the next slide, I think that actually is the last one. Okay, thanks to various people whose material I've been using, mainly members of my research group, and slide 100 is, and 101, got animation here. Again, that's it, I'm done, so thank you for listening, and I'll be happy to address some of the questions that have been going by in the chat, and any other questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ian. This is an excellent talk. We're going to actually get questions now. I would suggest that we address some of the questions in the chat session, but we want to make sure that people who are not on chat actually have an opportunity to. What I would suggest is that you raise your hand in the chat session, and Peter can confirm this.
Yes, the chat, the hand button is sort of on the lower right corner, near the send button. So if, let's queue everyone up. So if you have a question, if you have posted your questions onto the chat board already, raise your hands now. We probably would go through those people who had sort of put their questions down as placeholders first, and then we'll go through people in sequentially and try to cover the entire queue. So far, I've got three hands only, but obviously we had questions from Arturo, Amanda, and John Singer, Pierre Luigi, and so on. So Frank Chum, Bill Hogan.
Let me interject, Mr. Leo. I have to leave at 3 for another telecon, so Peter will take over for the question answering. I just want to express my appreciation to Ian for this talk.
Yeah, thanks, Leo. I'm sorry I did overrun a bit. I know we were a little bit late starting, I'd say, in my own defense, but sorry I did overrun a bit.
No problem at all. The session is supposed to be 1.5 to 2 hours, depending on whether we have got sort of a very interesting discussion session after the presentation, and obviously we are going to have one, so don't worry, we've got plenty of time.
Okay.
Leo, since you're leaving and you had a question, why don't you go first?
Okay, Ian, this is a typical question you'll get for description logic. Some believe that you need two languages. You need an expressive language for knowledge representation language for expressing your model, and then you need efficient reasoning at runtime, and that you need a transformation from one language, therefore, to another language. And, you know, people have used knowledge compilation techniques in the past to do that, whereas description logics kind of conflate both the, you know, development language and the runtime language. I just wondered if you had any comment on that.
Well, actually, in quite a number of applications of ontology languages in general, description logic-based ontology languages in particular, what people do is they develop the ontology using the full power of the language. But then when they actually use the thing in the application, actually the only thing they use is the computed flat hierarchy. I mean, that's actually quite common. That, for example, that is the case in many of the applications of SNOMED, that the people who use it actually just use, in the end, the taxonomy. So in a way, that's doing exactly what you were saying. You know, you start out with this rich language, you do some complex reasoning on it at design time, but then at deployment time, you compile it all away, and you just use you just use the hierarchy. I mean, there's nothing to stop you doing some version, something more or less extreme of that in your application.
Yes, but I mean, a lot of folks here believe that, you know, you need full first order rather than a subset, and then maybe reduce to, you know, description logic slash horn logic.
Well, that's possible as well. There's nothing, again, stopping you from using full first order logic at the ontology design phase. I mean, one of the things that's tricky is it's quite tricky to come up with some automated procedure that reduces your first-order logic into a suitable fragment in a reasonable way. You know, it's quite hard to define what reasonable might mean. The other thing I'd say that's tricky is that if you want to use your full first-order logic for ontology development, and you may run into difficulties because there just don't exist tools at the moment that are sufficiently robust to be able to deal with very large ontologies written in first order logic. I mean, we have problems even with these much simplified fragments that we're using that are description logic. It's quite hard to design tools, and I mean, I even explained that in AL2 we have this fragment AL2EL, but even a much smaller fragment of AL that whose main motivation is to provide good tractability for conceptual reason, which is mainly what you want to do at the ontology design phase. So yes, by all means, if you use full first order to design the ontology, you won't get much tool support for that. Nothing remotely compared to what you can get with OWL, and you may have some difficulty eventually deciding what you have to throw away from your ontology to end up with something that's now inside OWL.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Leo. Let's do this then. Rachuri from NIST. Notice you have had your hand up for quite a while. Sorry. Press star 3 and then check your voice first. Dr. Rachuri?
Hello?
Yes, you're coming through loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to go back to the question that I put in the beginning. I know Ian said that he'll address it later. The reason I put it that time is to see, if you look at the Snowbed CT, it had 400,000 components and things like that. So given this, and we went through this sort of slide, we said the cyclical definition of ontology could be a problem in terms of scalability. So what type of characteristics you can bring in to say that this is how this ontology will create a problem in terms of quality, and also what kind of best practices that you can build in when you're building an ontology?
So are you worried here about the kind of, you know, the correctness of the ontology? We haven't inadvertently written garbage in there. Is that what you mean by quality?
One of that, and also in terms of when somebody raised a question that heart disease is not a cardiovascular disease, if somebody has put that into the ontology, unless an expert in the domain captures that, any of the formalization or anything will not capture it because that is beyond the logic. The domain knowledge is needed to clean up that.
I'll try and answer. I'm not quite sure I fully understood all of your points there, but so in terms of trying to things like best practices for developing the ontology and so on, when you're developing very large ontologies like Nomad, obviously, that requires a team of domain experts, and it also requires quite a long time. I mean, SOMED is something that's been evolving. It's been through several kind of iterations and even sort of minor renamings over the years. Obviously, in those kinds of situations, it's quite difficult to maintain quality. all you can really do is provide tool support to try to help the process, and also provide some kind of methodology. So in the SOMED case, they have a very sort of regular structure of the design of the ontology. You know, every new term that's introduced basically consists of a refinement of some existing terms using a conjunction of attribute value pairs, which basically mean these additional existential quantifiers. So they have a sort of a very regular design methodology, and they also have a lot of kind of social structure in place, so that making major changes to the ontology has to go through a review process, and it has to be agreed, you know, that that's the appropriate thing to do, and so on. And then finally, they're using a wide range of ontology engineering tools that provide things like reasoning support, explanation, and so on, so that they can, they can test the quality of the ontology by posing various different queries and seeing whether the answer that they get is what they would deem to be the correct answer according to their knowledge of the domain. And if it's not the correct answer, then they can go and look at the ontology and find out what's going on. And also, when the reasoning tool runs, it will produce a list of all of the interesting inferences that it found. And again, domain experts can look at those and see if something unexpected came up. That doesn't guarantee it's good quality, but it provides some kind of basis for helping domain experts to maintain the quality to the best extent they can.
Okay. Thank you, but I don't want to hog the time, but I think I'll stop. Probably I'll send you an email later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I mean, may I prompt everyone who wants to queue up for making remarks to press their hand button and keep it there so that at least we have a queue to go through. And for Dr. Raturi, if you press the hand button again, that lowers your hand. And if I don't see a queue, then maybe I'll go through the chat board and go down the list of people who had sort of put a placeholder. Arturo Sanchez, Professor Sanchez, if you are online, *3, you can start your remarks and question. Arturo?
Thank you, Peter, for the opportunity. I just wanted to ask a simple question. If Professor Horrocks wants to comment on classes of problems for which OWL2 is particularly good, and also on the flip side, classes of problems for which OWL2 is particularly bad. Thank you.
Okay. That's a reasonable question. I mean, actually, I don't know if I'd necessarily focus on OWL2 specifically. I'd say, actually, any first-order-based ontology language. So, in many cases, the goodness and the badness may depend on whether or not you really find the open-world semantics to be appropriate in your application or not. I mean, actually, taking one step back even from there, what's an ontology language good for at all? As I was trying to explain, I think what it's good for is establishing a vocabulary and some meaning to that vocabulary. That's usually most useful when you are in domains that have relatively complex vocabularies, where it's useful to formalize the vocabularies and share them among people. So if you have a need for a shared and well-defined vocabulary, then you might be starting to think, oh, an ontology might sound good for that. Then comes the question, when would IL-2 be an appropriate language or not? Well, what are the good things about IL-2? It's quite powerful as ontology languages go. I mean, Leo was complaining a bit that it, you know, he'd like to use full first order language, and of course, anyone who's ever been involved in knowledge representation knows that, you know, you can never satisfy all requirements for expressive power. But OWL is pretty powerful, so if you need a powerful language, that it might be a good choice. It also has the advantage that there are these more tractable subsets if you can manage with a smaller language and you want the benefit to improve scalability. And it has the advantage of quite a big available tool set. The downsides, I would say, are, well, if you really insist on having database-level performance, it may be that you need to use a very weak version of the language, although you may still be able to manage that by using the L2QL profile. And it comes back, the last thing comes back to the point I was making about open and closed worlds. If your application is really checking constraints on data, then OWL isn't going to work well for you. You know, if you have an application that says something, you know, in your application, you want to check that every doctor must have an appropriate certificate from the medical licensing authority. If you add an axiom in an OWL ontology that seems to say that, what it really says is, you know, I can deduce that such a certificate must exist. And if what you really want to do is check your data, so you want to look at your data, and if I have a doctor, then I better have a certificate for that doctor. OWL isn't going to work well for that because it's not a constraint language like database constraint languages. It's really a deductive language. So it will, if you have a doctor that doesn't have a certificate, OWL will just allow you to deduce that, well, if this guy is a doctor, some such certificate must exist, because that's part of the definition of being a doctor. And, you know, that may be wrong for you if your application wants to check the data and flag up errors in the data where you have a doctor that doesn't have a certificate. So that's the most common misuse of OWL, I would say. I quite often get questions from people or even see people trying to use OWL in applications where that's what they want to do, and it isn't designed for that.
Okay, thank you, Ian. Thank you, Arturo. Actually, if I may suggest, as most of you already know, we have two OWL2 specific sessions coming up next Thursday and the Thursday that follows. So people who have OWL2 specific questions might want to hold off until those sessions, which Ian and also the expert panel he has pulled together might be answering some of those through their presentations, and then we definitely will have a whole bunch of time to delve into the discussion specifically around OWL to them. So, I saw Corey's hand, but Corey has now lowered his hand. Maybe this question was OWL to specific. So, Amanda, Star3, and Dr. Weisbaum, your turn. Star3, Amanda. Can't hear you yet.
You hear me now?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right, sorry. I got it wrong the first time. I'm going to skip past most of the questions I already put in the chat. They are largely OWL2 specific. There's a general one about description logic and expressivity in general, but Professor Horrocks, first, thank you for this. This has been a very, very well articulated presentation. I on your last this recent point about the mismatch between what constraints really are in OWL and what most people think of as constraint checking, I think is an extremely important point, and it's one that's causing a lot of application failures because people don't really understand it. I wondered if you had any comments on the increasingly common use of Sparkle or other querier tools and languages as a twin, really, a pair with a representation language in which those potential features or expressions are sort of offloaded to another layer.
That's a very nice question, and I think that it's essential that we have a standard query language as well as a standard representation language. And, you know, Sparkle is coming along really nicely now with it being extended to OWL. So, and people are already using Sparkle as a query language for OWL, actually, even before. So it's it was the de facto standard, but actually, there are quite a lot of critical issues that needed to be sorted out there, so the working group are doing a really nice job of that. And yes, it does turn out that you can often achieve the desired result with respect to checking on, in cases where you really want to check a constraint, you can often achieve the desired result using the query language. I mean, for example, If we want to ask this question about, if I want to check this constraint, doctors who don't have an appropriate certificate, I mean, actually I can ask a query that retrieves doctors and their certificates. And because of the nature of query answering, then I'll only get pairs of doctors and certificates where I really concretely know the certificate for that doctor. I won't get doctors where I don't know the certificate. And then I can issue another query for all doctors. And then I just have to, compare the two queries. I have to subtract the ones for whom I have certificates from the set of all doctors, and the ones that are left for the doctors that don't have certificates, and I might want to ask them, some questions to. And you can actually bundle up that whole operation in a single Sparkle query quite easily. And there's actually been some recent work from the Pellet guys. Evren Sirin was one of the authors, I think it was a paper of AAAI, where they described a way of extending OWL with, some specification of which axioms you meant as constraints and which axioms you meant as being entailment style axioms, material implications, and it automatically produces the appropriate Sparkle query for you that incorporates that kind of technique in order to work in a constraint setting.
Thank you.
Did I answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. I guess there's nobody in the queue, so maybe I'll follow up with one more. Something that I've heard some very mixed views on this practice, and one of the concerns that's sometimes raised is that those queries themselves or the way that they're being used represent knowledge that is not being captured declaratively. Your last comment seemed to suggest a new approach that might actually address that. I don't know so much about it. So
I understand what you're saying, that if you use the query engine to do this kind of constraint checking in that way, then in a certain sense you might say that actually the fact that this statement about doctors is meant to be treated as a constraint is being isn't being represented declaratively, and you're just capturing capturing it in the code of the application by writing some fancy queries. And that's true, and this is addressed to some extent by this new work that extends OWL with declarative statements about which of the OWL axioms you want to really treat as axioms and which ones you want to treat as constraints. I mean, having said all that, I think I'd also say that it's absolutely inevitable that in realistic applications, you do end up with some things being pushed into code. I mean, it's very nice that you can do absolutely everything declaratively, but typically that's not the case. If you look at database applications, you try to do as much as you can within the framework of the database system, but at some stage, you probably have to wrap some code around that that does some of the extra very specialized things that you need in your application. And I guess that realistically, our goal should be to minimize that, not necessarily to completely eliminate it. Nice if we could, but it might not be a realistic goal.
Would you agree that it might be an application context dependent, where that optimal place is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a sort of, to some extent, that's a choice for you as a sort of engineer to make as to where the sweet spot is for the complexity of, because, you know, building ontologies and pushing everything into the conceptual part is quite complex. But, you know, it has some benefits with respect to kind of transparency and maintainability in the longer term. So, you know, you have to make some decision about where the appropriate sweet spot is for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. I did notice on the chat board that Dr. Stavros Makrakis had a question, but he had to leave and deferred it to his colleague, Pierluigi Miraglia. Pierluigi, star 3, to cover your questions as well as Stavros. Star 3? We can't hear you yet. Test your voice after you've pressed star 3 on your phone. No? I can see Dr. Makrakis is still on the chat board. And if you're still online, maybe you can take your question personally. No, maybe he had to go. Corey Cartonish. Corey, you had a question and then you lowered your hand and you're typing. Maybe you want to ask your question verbally? Yes, star 3, Corey. Can't hear you yet.
So, okay, well actually, I don't really agree that I was assuming an ontology under a single authority.
Ian, could you repeat the question, if you please?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So Corey,
for the recording.
Sorry, I don't know how you pronounce sorry for that, but anyway, your question was, follow-up on fragility, your response assumes an ontology under a single authority. In a federated knowledge base, which is not practical, can the LBUs in an open federated environment like the web? Well, I mean, of course it can be used. Obviously, in any situation, if you have a sort of federated environment where multiple people can change things, then no matter what technology you're using, you're potentially going to run into difficulties where You know, we see this all the time on the web where, you know, we get into battles where people are changing things backwards and forwards, or where somebody just decides to, you know, try to trash the information, or whatever. So, I mean, obviously, you know, there's nothing magic about encryption logic. They can't do anything to address those kinds of problems. They still exist. And basically, you know, they're a very simple tool that just allows you to ask the question, what follows from, what implicit facts follows from the explicit facts that I've stated. And you can use that to help decide whether or not you like or trust the information that you find out there, which is a useful thing in the web setting. I mean, one of the things I'm very often asked is, well, you know, surely in a web setting there'll be so much information out there that if I take it all, it's bound to be contradictory. You know, anything that, any statement of fact I can find on the web, I can find the statement exactly the opposite fact somewhere else. And yes, this is true, but this is kind of making the assumption that your application is either going to try to work with the whole of the web and reason with everything that's represented on the whole of the web, which would obviously be completely insane, and no application would be able to do that. You wouldn't be able to do that even if, you know, even if you were just running a database. You have to select some subset of the web that you like, trust, whatever your criteria is. You select some subset of the web, you work with that. And what description logic provides, what any reasoning system provides, is just a tool that helps you to determine if this subset that you pick satisfies you. I mean, the first question you might ask is this subset, when I take it all together, logically inconsistent? You know, does it contain two statements like A is true, A is false? And if the subset you pick does contain such contradictions, you may want to think twice about whether that was a good selection, or you may want to decide which one of those two facts to throw away in order to get to a subset that doesn't contain logical contradictions. So the DL can help you, a reasoning system can help you to explore the set of information you have, potentially identify problems with it, but it isn't a magic solution and it won't necessarily fix the problem.
Thank you, Ian. Hope that answers your question, Corey. We have Brian Hawk, hands up. Brian? Star 3. Test your voice.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to follow up related to that last question, is the issue of representing provenance in owl ontology. And I was wondering what Professor would recommend with regard to how you represent, you know, the source, the confidence, the security classification level, that sort of thing. You know, especially given the restriction of OWL ontologies to binary predicates, whether you recommend using reification or trying to put that kind of information in the annotation data.
I definitely recommend putting that kind of information in the annotation data. I mean, this was one of the motivations for in OWL 2 extending the power of the annotation mechanism. In OWL 1, it was only possible to annotate entities. In OWL 2, you can annotate axioms and you can annotate more or less anything.
And can you say anything about
you can annotate annotations.
Could you say anything about
the one of the
support for reasoning with annotations?
Sorry, I'm talking across someone. Carry on.
I was trying to ask if you could say anything about tool support for reasoning with annotations, because my understanding is, in general, that annotations were not designed to be reasoned with. And, of course, one of the things in assessing provenance and the reliability of sources is to be able to, you know, assess that in a reasoning tool, for example, combining information at different levels of security classification, changes to security classification, that sort of thing.
Right. There are several different ways that you can address that using OWL. One thing is that you can use terms in annotations that you define in another ontology. There's nothing at all to stop you doing that. So you may have a sort of, you know, ontology of trustworthiness and security levels and all those things where you can define vocabulary appropriate for that. And then you can use the terms from that vocabulary in your annotations. And then that gives you a means to do some sort of basic reasoning about the annotation. So, you know, if some annotation says that a particular piece of information is, you know, highly untrustworthy, you can go across and look at your security ontology and discover that that means it's untrustworthy and that, you know, that means that you shouldn't use it in applications that require you only to use information that's, you know, at least trustworthy or this kind of thing. That's one way you can go. Another way that you can go is to actually, there was a paper at, I'm going to struggle a bit to identify exactly when it was, but AAAI a couple of years ago, where I have to admit being one of the co-authors, but the work was really done by Boris Motic and another guy from Karlsruhe University whose name I forget. When, you know, sorry to have to admit this, you know, but when you've done this, what did Leo say at the beginning, 150 pages, you can't even remember what they all were. But there was this one, anyway, that described how you could structure annotations in such a way that it was possible to extract the information from the annotations and transform them directly into another ontology about which you could do reasoning. And this was precisely to address issues like provenance and so on. It was an application where they were trying to extract information from the web about kind of competitors' products, and they needed to know where that information had come from, how trustworthy it was, and so on. So you might want to try looking at that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hawk. And
I'm going to have to go.
Yes.
It's about 8:30 p.m. here. And
right.
I guess it'll be a case of your dinner is in the dog, unless I head off home fairly soon.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly what I'm going to do. We're running out of time, and this has been an excellent session, a great talk. Thank you very, very much, Professor Horrocks. And as I mentioned on the chat board, two more sessions coming up next Thursday and the Thursday after that, specifically on OWL2. Professor Horrocks will introduce us to the OWL2 standard and specification next week, and then he will bring together an expert panel the week after that to tell us more about tools and applications. So if you haven't already registered, drop me a note. And again, thank you all for participating today. I mean, this has been a great crowd. And for those who are here for the first time and for those who are not already part of the Ontolog community, please consider joining us if this aligns well with your professional interests. So thank you very much again, Professor Horrocks, and thank everyone. This is it. See you next week.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa, and thanks everyone for listening. Hope I didn't bore you too much.
That was a great talk. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.